I'm a booger. I'm a booger booger. I'm a booger. I'm a booger 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 booger.
This is a special edition of I'm a Booker Booker. It's from a previous podcast series we produced called Extraordinary Lives. The episode, which was recorded 2 years ago, was never released, but we're releasing it now to coincide with the 109th anniversary of the birth of Bram Fischer, the South African president we should have had.
Today's extraordinary life is extraordinarily extraordinary. He came from Afrikaner royalty. His grandfather was Prime Minister of the Orange Free Colony, and his father was Judge President of the Free State. He started life as an Afrikaner nationalist, and at 20 he was elected nationalist Prime Minister at a student parliament. If he had continued along this political path, he might have become Prime Minister of South Africa. Instead, he fought apartheid and became a communist. To the establishment, he was the worst kind of traitor. But to the oppressed, Bram Fischer was a hero. We are recording at Lilliesleaf Farm, which is where many of the Rivonia treason trialists were arrested in a police raid in 1963. Bram defended the Rivonia trialists. He could easily have been one of them. Championing Bram is Lord Joel Joffe, a human rights lawyer who moved to the United Kingdom and worked in the financial services industry and the voluntary sector. As chair of the Joffe Charitable Trust, he pursues a range of humanitarian activities. In 1963, Lord Joffe went boldly where no other lawyer was prepared to go. He agreed to represent the Rivonia accused as their attorney, an act of remarkable courage. Joel, why Bram?
Bram was simply the finest human being I've ever met. He combined all the qualities that everyone aspired to, of compassion, of courage, of brilliance, of intelligence, and of warmth and care. That he is my hero and has always been the person who always tried to emulate, but at a much lower level.
When did you meet him for the first time? Can you recall?
I think the very first time I met Bram was actually when I was an article clerk in a case where Bram was a QC, a leading counsel, and when two tobacco companies were suing each other. It was the biggest civil case ever heard in South Africa. And I met him when my job was to deliver some papers to him. And the only thing I remember is no person whom I ever delivered papers to had ever said thank you. And Bram was so warm and friendly and accepting the papers. That was the very first time.
I'd like to introduce Ilse Wilson, Bram's daughter. Ilse, we know a lot about Bram, the revolutionary. Can you tell us about Bram, the father?
Yeah, I mean, Bram was all these things. He was warm and loving. And you know, you can't talk about Bram without talking about Molly,
yes,
who was his wife, and who was actually the strength in the family. I mean, she kept it all together so that Bram could be the front man. But, you know, as a family man, he made time for the family as well as for everybody else. And I think that was quite extraordinary, was his ability to make time for everybody. You know, there were streams of people coming to the door. So our lives were not as peaceful as some children's lives.
When did you realize that your parents were different to other children's parents?
You know, from very early on. I mean, we grew up with a black sister. My parents had taken on a child when she was very young. We always had people of other races as part of our home life. But we also had friends who also had those kind of lives. So, you know, you had one life at school and one life with your friends.
And when you were at school, your sister Ruth said that Bram would fetch her wearing khaki Boer shorts and speaking Afrikaans very loudly, and she was very embarrassed by this. Were you embarrassed when Bram came to fetch you?
You know, she was the firstborn. It was more difficult for her. For me, it was easier. First of all, Bram was much busier when I was at school, so I saw less of him. He was less involved in the school, I guess. But yeah, I mean, you know, as a young teenager, one is embarrassed by one's parents anyway.
Yes.
And, you know, if your friends come and there's Moses Kutani sitting at the dining room table having supper with us, you know, it's just different.
I think the significance of what Ilse says, one doesn't appreciate it today, but it was unique, almost unique, to have a non-white person in a white family, and there was a black sister, and to have, and this would differentiate your life completely as a young person from anyone else. I went to a white school, and I went to, and one was, as part of society in those days, you lived as if you lived in a white, in a white world where there were non-white people who were your servants, but they weren't equal.
Yes.
And when I went to the Fisher family for the first time and saw black people in the swimming pool, I was aghast.
But this is in his trial, he gave a speech from the dock where he explains the moment he realized that apartheid was wrong. Ilse, how did Brom explain apartheid to you?
Well, I mean, just that it was wrong. I mean, it was, you know, Brom had grown up in a nationalist family, but their nationalism was really anti-imperialist.
Yeah.
It was anti-colonialism. So when he had this Damascus moment, when he had to shake the hands with a black man, and, you know, he found it uncomfortable. You know, what other people might well have done was, well, you know, uncomfortable, move on. But Brom went home and thought about it. You know, it was a sort of self-reflection, which I think was quite extraordinary. And, you know, he remembered that he'd grown up on a farm, well, a small holding, really. and his best friends were two black boys on the farm. And they played together and, you know, roamed the veld together and that sort of thing. And he realized he was the one who had changed. And so, yeah, and he thought about it and he realized that actually the struggle for freedom was not just for the Afrikaner, it was for all people.
In fact, Joel, Nelson Mandela described Brom as one of the bravest and staunchest friends of the freedom struggle that I've ever known. From a prominent Afrikaner family, he gave up a life of privilege, rejected his heritage, and was ostracized by his own people, showing a level of courage and sacrifice that was in a class by itself. Where did Brom get this courage from?
I think from his basic humanity. Brom was a person who cared about people, and when he saw injustice, it just came naturally to him, I must do something about it. And the way his whole career and life developed was in trying to make a difference. And his own interests and personal interests were always secondary because of the humanity of the man. But what he coupled it with is not only humanity, but extraordinary courage and great, multi-talented in every respect, from academic to sports, where he has, he was almost a hero for the Afrikaner nation at 20, representing the Free State at rugby, a scrum off against the All Blacks.
Yes, yeah.
You know, this could get you to Prime Minister by itself. what he cared about his people.
But he still had an Afrikaner identity. Oh. And how important was his, you know, sort of being an Afrikaner?
Oh, it was very important to him. It was extraordinarily important to him. And he never lost, you know, that identity. In fact, he always said that come change, the Afrikaners would change more easily than the English. I'm not sure he's right, but, you know, it's that was his belief.
Yeah.
Yes, and actually his fight was, amongst many other things, to actually save the Afrikaner nation. Because but for people like Brom, the non-whites could have easily turned against the white population when they took power, and the retribution could have been appalling.
Absolutely.
And most Afrikaners might well have had to emigrate, providing they survived. But Brahm was determined, among all everything else, to actually ensure that the Afrikaner nation people could carry on and being part of this community and nation where everybody was equal.
Joel, you and Brahm worked on the Rivonia treason trial. What was it like working with Brahm?
It was an immense privilege to work with Brahm, because basically he was a sort of, his humanity went into his law, so he behaved always towards everybody with care and thought and protective. He was protective, and yet he was so committed that to what he was doing, that he was such an outstanding lawyer that he inspired you, both because he was a great lawyer, but also because he was a great person. So it was a wonderful privilege to work with Brahm.
I read that a number of documents seized at Rivonia were in fact in his own handwriting. Were you aware of that during the trial?
We were rather naive, some of the lawyers, or I was at any rate. I think Werner Berenzer, possibly George Bezos, but Arthur Chaskerson and I were sort of we were a lot more naive. But when it became apparent to us was during the trial, the police, the prosecutor suddenly produced a very inflammatory document criticizing the apartheid government. It was a signed document, and he handed it. So the prosecutor said, "Well, who signed this?" And so it was handed over in court to a handwriting expert, who looked at it very carefully and said, "Yes, this is the signature of Harold Walpe." And the paper was then handed back, as is the custom in the Lords in court, to the counsel for the defence, and they handed this paper to Brahm, who looked at it casually and gave it across to George, and George looked at it, and then I said, he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, "It's Brahm's handwriting." But this was the measure of Brahm. He could deal with a situation like that. Anyone else would have collapsed.
What did you learn from him during that trial?
I learned that there were some lawyers, some people who were so exceptional that you would do well to try to follow what they did and to do within your own limited talents what they could do.
Because Joel was set to immigrate before the Rivonia trial.
You're on your way to Australia.
Yes.
But you decided.
And they bullied him into taking the trial.
What an excellent bullying.
These were the wives of the trialists.
Yes.
And nobody else would take the trial.
Take the trial. There was something very illuminating, and it was really a great educational experience. Hilda Bernstein, who was Rusty Bernstein's wife, was the first person to come to see me, and she said, "Would I take the trial?" And I said, "Well, you know, it's a pretty hopeless trial." If you'd read the paper, they've already been hanged. I said, "Oh, well, I'll take the trial, but Hilda, I must tell you that actually the majority of public opinion is totally opposed to these people and will be very pleased to see them disappear." And Hilda looked at me aghast and she said, "What do you mean the majority of the population? You're talking about the whites, but the majority, this is their leader sometimes." Yeah. And that was a very good experience for me, being a white young man who had grown up in a white society, to remember that you're part of a minority.
Ilse, on your 17th birthday, you went to visit Molly, who was in jail, and I read that she gave you some violets that she had picked.
That's right. That's right.
And I just wanted to know, in some sense, kind of, you were deprived a normal birthday. How does that make you feel? Were you resentful?
No, I wasn't resentful. I was the conforming daughter, in fact. So I accepted what was handed out to me. So Ruth was already in Cape Town when that was 1960, during the state of emergency, which people have forgotten about. I mean, it was the first state of emergency, and although conditions weren't as horrific as they later were, you know, it was, one didn't know. I mean, people were locked away, and one didn't know if they'd ever come out.
Yeah.
And I was allowed to visit because I was 16. Ruth was in Cape Town. Paul was too young, my brother, to visit. So I did a lot of the visiting and the minding of the family, in fact. And I was lucky that, you know, Molly could pick some violets in the Pretoria prison and push them through the grills. There were sort of tight little grills, so just one violet at a time.
Wow. What was she like?
Molly was fantastic. She, as I said before, was a strength in the relationship. Yes. But she also had a nice sense of humor, and, you know, we would have fun together. But she was as committed, probably more committed than Brown.
And
was an extraordinary woman.
But so delightful a woman as well, with all these enormous pressures on her. You went to her home, and she was so warm and friendly and always so attentive.
Mm.
And she would sit down, and the cake and the tea would appear. And this is a lady who's working in the underground with immense courage and carrying the tremendous burden of a husband who was in danger all the time, and she was as well of a rest. And in fact, Ilse's anything but the quiet young lady. She wasn't aware. She was immensely courageous in her own right and played a very important part when Brown was underground and elsewhere.
And when your parents weren't involved in politics, what did they do sort of for fun?
They gardened.
Yeah.
Brahm loved the felt. I mean, that was something that, you know, lasted forever. We had lots of lovely holidays. We would go to the game reserve quite a lot. We would go down to the Free State to Brahm's mother, who was still on the same small holding. And, we'd go for picnics and things. I mean, you know, I think to relax with the family, we had to actually get out of the house and go somewhere else.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a lovely garden.
It was a lovely garden.
A lovely garden, which is Molly's pride, wasn't it?
Mm.
In 1963, your mother died in a car accident.
Mm.
How did the family cope with this death at such a difficult time when Brahm himself was under so much
pressure? Well, Brahm was devastated, of course, because he was driving. And as a, you know, it was an extraordinary relationship that they had. And, it was just absolutely devastating.
Yeah.
And he felt responsible for it because he'd been driving.
Yeah.
But what was so extraordinary about Brahm, despite his unbelievable grief and devastation, the next day, virtually the day after the funeral, he went off with me to Robben Island to see the Nelson Mandela and the other accused. And he just drove himself. And there was an extraordinary event when we met the accused, the seven of them who were at Robben Island for the very first time to discuss an appeal. And as we walked in, Walter Sisulu said to Brahm, "How is Molly?" And Brahm sort of bit his lip and said, "Molly's okay." And basically what he didn't want to do was to allow his own grief and suffering to add to the suffering of the accused. And he got through that whole interview giving them clear legal advice. And it just shows just one of the extraordinary depths of courage and ability of this unique human being.
Yeah. It wasn't long after that he was arrested and charged with being a member of the Communist Party. And then he got bail and he went to London and he came back and then decided to go underground. Did he discuss going underground with you before?
Oh yes. I mean, I helped him go underground.
Yeah. How old were you at that point?
No, I was old. I was 21.
21, okay.
So, Yeah, I mean, he'd made the decision quite early on. He had discussed it with Ivan Schoenbrock and Elie Weinberg, who were the two senior people on trial with him for being members of the Communist Party. And they'd agreed that this is something he should do. You know, those late 60s, there'd been lots of trials, and really there was very little political activity. It was really, you know, after Rovonia, there were many other trials as well. And I think he just felt he had to do something. You know, he couldn't just give up.
And where did the name Douglas Black come from?
Look, he went underground. He thought, because he'd been to London for that trial, he thought that he would get much more support than he did. He got very little support from England. But eventually, I think they got false documents in that name. I don't know who made it up. We called him Max. But, I mean, it was crazy. I was visiting him once a week. I shouldn't, you know, with the cops following me all the time.
Yes, I only realized, it only came back to me again that when you took him underground, you drove him,
yes,
and he was locked up in the boot, and you had to wave at the policeman watching. She was the courier.
But he had a sense of humor. Yeah. So, in fact, he wasn't in the boot, he was behind the back seat. How he fitted, I don't know, with a little Volkswagen on the floor at the back seat. And then the first message I got from him when he was underground was something about pink heels. It was a bit of a garbled message, and I thought, well, I better go and check under the car. What was this? And I got into a panic. What was the encoded message? And it was nothing more than saying, all he could see when we left the house were my pink heels on the pedals.
It seems he was eventually rearrested and sentenced to life imprisonment. But it seems in prison he was singled out for extra cruelty. He was forbidden from going to Paul's funeral. And he was also forbidden from attending your wedding, which you had asked to have in the prison so that he could be there. How did he sort of bear this extra, you know, cruelty? How did he cope with that?
I think the first year or so was very tough. That's when they really leaned on him. And he and Izzy Hayman were kept separate from the other political prisoners. But when they moved in with the others, it was much easier. It was, you know, they were together, they exercised together, they could study. I mean, I think the cruelest thing for a lot of the political prisoners was not being allowed any news. I mean, it was such a vindictive thing.
Yeah.
You know, these were all people who had, you know, lived for what was going on and cared about, obviously, politics, but everything else. And, you know, you were not allowed to say anything to them or write anything. And so that was a huge burden. But, yeah.
I think, as I put it in a speech, was that being Brown, he could cope with anything. And it was just him. There's nothing he could not cope with. Any normal person would have caved in long before, but washing urinals at the police and being dragged around and being victimized, he could cope with. Normal people couldn't. Well, that's why he's such a great man. Among many things, he's such a great man. He was good at all levels. In court, leading the defense. In underground, leading the underground. In jail, leading the prisoners.
You mentioned that you wanted to emulate Brown, but what impact did he have on your life?
Yes. I didn't say I wanted to emulate
Brown. You wanted to emulate.
I wanted to try to be to do the best I could, which was a far way from that. Sorry, what was the question?
What impact did he have on your life?
It had an immense impact. He was a model, my hero. And if I wanted to judge my conduct in any case, I'd think, well, what would Brown do?
And what impact did he have on South Africa?
I think he had an immense impact on everyone, because here was a white man fighting for everybody, and an Afrikaner as well. And I think his impact, it was an impact also through the black leaders that he dealt with, and that he dealt with, and they realized this was that there were good whites, there were whites who were their equals and who were as committed as they were. And I think this affected their, helped to affect the attitude of the leaders, the non-white leaders, towards the white people. And he was instrumental in that. And as I've said, I think the role that he played as an Afrikaner was of immense benefit to all Afrikaners in this country, and that I don't think it is recognized by most of them, even today, is my impression. But Ruth, I mean, Ilse would have a better idea.
Ilse, what do you feel when you're driving along and then you turn into Bram Fischer Drive?
Well, it's okay until I come to Bram Fischer KFC. Then I kind of gulp.
But do you feel anything?
No, look, I think that, you know, obviously one feels a pride there. And, you know, it's very nice to fly into Bloemfontein Airport.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's good that he's been honored now. But I just want to go back to something Joel said, which is, I think one of Brahms' gifts, and I can also tell you about, you know, when he lost his temper and things like that,
yes.
But one of his gifts was that he saw the best in people, and therefore people gave of their best. And I think that's quite an important gift to have himself.
Yes.
That, you know, if you expect people to behave properly, they try to quite often.
So what made him lose his temper?
If people assumed that he couldn't do something, and there was one famous occasion when Molly was in detention and somebody had called, and a woman who was staying with us said, no, Brahm can't come to the phone because his ulcer is playing up. And Brahm was absolutely furious. And he had a to roast meat, which one had in those days, and Brahm carved it so that the meat flew all over the place. And Nora, who was my black sister, sat there weeping, and I was weeping, and Brother Paul was saying, rum, 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 muttering under his breath. Fortunately, the woman left the next day. But yeah, so that, you know, yeah. He was human. I think we mustn't paint him as
yes.
not human.
Yes.
Well, it's very interesting when you talk about Brahm in the whole, and the parallels between him and Nelson Mandela. I once did a talk on the parallels of these two extraordinary human beings, and the similarities were so marked that they were wonderful courage, brilliance in their fields, caring and compassionate, but human as well.
Yeah,
and that they might have made occasional losing tempers. Similarly, Nelson Mandela, charming and wonderful to every person, irrespective of how important. He also recognized himself as a human being who made mistakes from time to time. But these were so insignificant in the whole, but it is important to remember that there, when you look at these, the two finest people I've ever met, to realize that complete perfection is not attainable, but they were as close to that perfection as any human being could be.
Ilse, what do you think Brahm would have thought of the country today, and what would he have done about it?
He would have been thrilled by the Constitution and by the fact that apartheid had ended. But, you know, he was a socialist, and he would be very distressed by things like the unequalness of the society, by the greed, by the lies people tell. I mean, that would have caused him great sadness. You know, Ray Alexander, when she came back from exile, said sadly, I never thought the comrades would be so greedy. And I think that would have been Brahm's attitude as well.
And Joel, what do you think Brahm's legacy is?
I think that he is His legacy is that he is an example to everyone in this, everyone in the country, of all races, as someone who believes in freedom, who believes in justice, and is willing to commit their lives to it. So he is an inspiration to those of the younger generation who South Africa is so dependent upon for its future. And one of the great advantages of interviews like this, of colloquiums, of things honouring Braam, is that others know that there was such a person whom they should try to model themselves on.
Braam Fischer.
And sorry, and very important, I think that a key part of his legacy is the role he played in ensuring that the Afrikaans nation and the Afrikaans-speaking people could live happily in South Africa.
Braam Fischer was a keen rugby player and played a scrum half against the All Blacks. I typed Braam Fischer into the Twitter search and there were hundreds of entries like quick day update on Braam Fischer situation, hashtag traffic, delays in Randburg on Republic Road westbound approaching Braam Fischer, touchdown Braam Fischer, I'm home, hashtag yay. Braam Fischer has entered the South African lexicon. The airport in Bloemfontein is the Braam Fischer International Airport. There's an annual Braam Fischer Memorial Lecture, and Hendrik Verwoerd Drive is now Braam Fischer Drive. A person who represented hate, repression, and discrimination has been replaced by one who is a symbol of freedom, peace, and justice. Braam Fischer, also known as Mr. Black, also known as the Red Pimpernel, was a brilliant lawyer, a doting husband and father, a communist and a comrade, who instead of becoming a prime minister, became a prisoner. Braam Fischer, an extraordinary life indeed. Thank you, Ilse. Thank you, Joel.
Thank you, Jonathan.
This edition of Extraordinary Lives was produced by Jonathan Anser and Dan Dews. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.